What if I told you about an election district that looks a lot like California generally, almost the same breakdown of Republicans versus Democrats, but it's the Republican in this deep blue district who keeps winning, and by double digits? Instead of the most contested race this election cycle is probably the safest of this year's battlegrounds. And it all has to do with what many refer to as California's sleeping giant. This is Keys to the House. I'm Ben Bradford. The largest ethnic or racial demographic in California are Latinos, almost 40% of the state's population, and they overwhelmingly vote for Democrats. But Latinos are also much less likely to vote than other demographics. Today, we're talking about why and how it affects California's battleground races. And that brings us to Republican Congressman David Valadao. Valadao is outnumbered by Democrats in his district, way outnumbered. Only 28% of the voters are registered with the GOP, and 45% are Democrats. But Valadao has won three elections in a row, and it has not been close.
I don't even think the Valadao district is really a competitive district anymore.
Yeah, you don't think it's the battleground at all?
No, and I haven't for some years.
Republican strategist Mike Madrid joins me on this episode.
People, I think, like to because of the registration numbers, and it seems anomalous.
And it's one of the ones where Hillary Clinton won the presidential vote in 2016.
And Obama's won it before, too.
The reason I wanted to talk about the Latino vote in particular today, and the reason I start with that Valadao district, is because, you know, it's 70% Latino, and less than half of the actual voters who turned out were Latino.
The key thing, I think, what you're getting at is there are not only a large percentage of voters, but there are many more that are not voting.
And that's Mindy Romero from the California Civic Engagement Project.
Not registered to vote, but yet eligible to vote. That large population, if mobilized to some degree, right, could play a greater role.
Yeah, this is sort of the sleeping giant expression, which maybe we roll our eyes at, particularly considering.
We do.
Yeah. But I mean, the idea behind this is that based just purely on the population, you know, that Latinos are the largest racial or ethnic demographic in California, and they don't play that role in politics.
That's correct.
Why is there this big disparity? That's like the big question, right?
Well, I definitely have my own opinions. I've been very vocal about them, and it's
go ahead.
Yeah, no, I will. It's the reason why I think people kind of their eyes kind of turn when I start to say this is because it's not sexy. Most people want to say, "Oh, if we just made it easier to vote, if we just had voting process centers, if we just had everybody vote by mail, and if everybody could vote on your phone, right?" We're always looking for these simple, sexy solutions. The reality is the reason why Latinos are not voting, largely, not entirely, but largely, is no different than with other demographics that we've seen with 70 years of census data. And that is largely it's an income and economic problem. It's a class issue. Is Latinos are disproportionately at the lower end of the economic ladder. And they are increasingly, like most Americans, but to a greater degree, feeling that government is not either speaking to their concerns and certainly not addressing their concerns. A lot of people characterize that as apathy. I don't believe that is apathy. In many ways, there's a rational basis for not voting. If it literally does not make a difference, that's just not me not caring. Their lives are not getting better. So there's really no point in doing it. And that is largely a class phenomenon. So if you're poor African American in Mississippi or poor white in Appalachia, or poor Latino in Los Angeles, your propensity to vote is virtually identical, and that is very, very low. And while voting behavior is collapsing amongst all classes right now for all sorts of reasons, it's really disparate at the lower ends of the economic ladder. And as we all know and should know, California is not just the wealthiest state in the nation, it is the poorest state in the nation, and we are growing our poverty problem. And as we grow our poverty problem, it undermines the underpinnings of civic engagement, voting behavior, and I would argue even democracy.
And you already mentioned age as well. I mean, we know that younger people don't vote as much, and that
and younger
is
people are
part
poor.
Of it.
And younger people are poor,
okay.
too.
And are there other things that you would add to that, Mindy?
Yeah, and I don't necessarily disagree with anything that Mike just said. The reality is, you know, I've done a lot of work in my career. There's been a lot of effort in this state to focus on electoral reforms, the institutional side of things. All of that is important, very important, and we should be continuing to open up access, make it easier to both register and to vote, particularly for underrepresented groups. But the research also tells us that Even in a perfect world where these reforms or and additional reforms are implemented correctly and people are accessing them and knowing about them and using them, they will only give us so much. Each individual reform, at best, a few percentage points. That's a lot in terms of increase in voter turnout world, but it doesn't get us to where I think we all want to be, right, which is a representative voting electorate and a robust democracy. So we have to be looking at all these other reasons that we don't see high turnout for everybody, particularly for Latinos. And what I would add to what Mike said, certainly a huge factor for why we see low turnout for Latinos is that they're overrepresented in other groups that predict low turnout. So lower income, lower education. That isn't the only factor.
Renters.
Renters, thank you. It certainly isn't the only factor, but those are key drivers. The other aspect that we haven't talked about really is the lack of mobilization and outreach, right? That kind of vicious cycle. That really, really is a key factor in all of this. And it certainly is a key tool to counter these trends when we talk about wanting to overcome or at least attempt to overcome the poverty picture. Outreach and mobilization we need to be working on our economy. We need to be changing some of those realities, certainly. But also, and certainly in the meantime, we need to be trying to overcome those barriers, and it's difficult.
And that's like a fascinating point to me. You both brought up separately when I was like, hey, come on the show and talk about this. Basically, it has to do with who campaigns reach out to.
It matters. I don't think it's the biggest challenge, but there's no question it matters. You know, we buy data from largely the same vendor or vendors in this state, and it's really good data, and for good reason. They sell us the likeliest voters. And many campaigns have spoken only to those likely voters. And as Latinos miss an election, if you miss, you know, one election, then we slowly start to cut you out of the universe, and so that starts another downward trend.
Let me add one more thing to that. Let's be honest here. It's not just that campaigns aren't reaching out to Latinos and other underrepresented groups. First off, we know from a practical standpoint, strategic standpoint, there are limited resources. Campaigns are trying to get right voters that will vote for them. Some of that I would counter that there is evidence, lots of research now that shows us that if campaigns did put the extra mile, if they invest in one-on-one, person-to-person kind of engagement, which is more costly and more time-consuming, but it can be very effective. So we put that aside. Let's be honest about something else. They're not necessarily looking for, most campaigns and candidates, there's always exceptions, but they're not necessarily looking for new voters. They are really looking for the folks that they can bank on, right? They've run the numbers. And Mike, you can disagree with me on any of this. But I think in large part, there are always exceptions, but they're looking strategically for when they run the numbers, right? When they calculate who are not only going to vote for them, but they can pretty much bet it's going to vote for them, right? That's the return on investment. New voters, even of the same party, right? So registering a lot of Latinos, right, that are going to skew Democrat, still can be risky. It isn't a guarantee that those new voters are going to be voting for your candidate or your party's endorsed candidate. And it's in part, at least, why we don't see nearly what we would expect to see in California in terms of engagement and investment by the Democratic Party into the Latino community when it comes to registration and get out the vote.
So I think that's right. I think that's all right. I think there's a little bit more nuance. So Republicans also started to choose this path of messaging in the mid-1990s that was very vitriolic and very viewed as very anti-immigrant. I don't think there's any question that the vast majority of Latinos felt that the Republican Party was openly hostile to the community. Okay,
Proposition 187, for instance.
And we talked about this in our first episode.
There's an important point here because what happened as a practical matter at that same time is Republicans started to compete less and less for the vote. In fact, we're actually running against the Latino vote to mobilize and win by wider margins with white voters, like what happened with Proposition 187.
And 187 was the proposition that would have banned undocumented immigrants from receiving essentially any state services, including access to public schools.
Right. So what that means is Republicans stop investing in the Latino community. When that happens, Democrats stop investing too, which may sound counterintuitive, but basically what happened is Republicans ceded that vote. There was no more investment required by the Democrats to cultivate that voter base statewide. And as the state became more of a one-party state, there were less and less dollars invested by both Republicans and Democrats to engage these voters, to Mindy's point. Okay? So when you stop investing in terms of campaigns and communications and messaging, And also important, you no longer need to address the issues of concern to the community. It has this really nasty effect of people disengaging. One, they're not aware of the vote. No one is asking for their vote. And just as importantly, neither party is speaking to the issues that they are concerned about. And the problem has been compounding for a couple of decades now. But after 20 years of doing this and continually hitting, you know, lows for a long period of time, we have now hit a point where, and this is where I would disagree with Mindy a little bit,
sure,
there is an efficiency in finding what we would call, quote unquote, new voters. We are spending more on newer voters than we have at any time in my 25-year history of doing campaigns.
Okay.
And I think it's because of a lot of the reforms, to the Secretary of State's credit and other elected officials' credit. The more we have expanded online registration, the more we have developed new technology to bring and engage people. Yes, we are targeting new voters, the 18 to 24 demographic, by a wider margin than I've ever seen in the last 25 years of races.
So if we're starting to reach out to more people, and as a matter of fact, I mean, I don't want to open up a recent wound here, but you, Mike, you're a Republican, but you went...
I've got a lot of wounds as a result of that. So don't worry about new ones.
Well, the newest is that you actually
went... I think he can handle it.
Yeah. You went and helped run the campaign for Antonio Villaraigosa, a Democratic candidate for governor.
Yeah.
And the strategy for that, it seems like a lot of the strategy for that was to mobilize Latino voters and lower income voters.
Right.
So it fits in with the sort of philosophy that you're saying there.
Right.
But ultimately, in the numbers, we didn't really see that kind of turnout, did we?
Well, I don't know what you mean by turnout, but let me explain a little bit about what happened, because I do think it's very instructive. The policy debates are going to happen in the Democratic Party in California for the next generation. And they're largely going to be about this break, this class break in California, where wealthy white progressives have an issues and values set that are very different than the younger, poor, browner emerging electorate, especially, again, on economic issues. And that tension within the Democratic Party is going to define where California goes and how it is governed. In fact, I would argue that the issue set between those two groups is... the only thing keeping those two groups in coalition is the fact that they really dislike Republicans. That's mainly what they have in common. But let me give you some very specific examples. Gavin Newsom, for example, would say income inequality is my number one issue on the stump. This widening gap between rich and poor is something we have to address. But never once in his commercials did he ever articulate that. It was all about gay marriage. It was about gun control. It was about legalization of marijuana, all these social issues that spoke to his wealthier, white, progressive, coastal base. And he won overwhelmingly with that constituency. Antonio took a different tack. And what he was saying is, we are leaving California behind. And when those are the issues that we talk about, there is an enormous and growing swath of people that are being left behind. And with those voters, Antonio won commandingly by, you know, 2-3 to 1 with that demographic. The problem was the same turnout problem that we've been talking about for the past 10, 15 minutes. And that problem isn't necessarily going to go away in one election cycle. It's going to take a generation or something cataclysmic to actually force voters to go to the polls.
The overwhelming issue of the 2016 campaign and since then has been this relentless focus, to some extent, vilification of undocumented immigrants. I mean, that has been the story from this administration, mm-hmm. right? And when we talk about issues of concerns to the Latino community, is that not going to be enough to drive out turnout? And if not, what issues would be?
Look, you had a record turnout amongst Latinos nationally in the November 2016 elections, okay? What has always intrigued me about studying the Latino vote, it is almost always characterized by the rare instances when there are these spikes in turnout are characterized almost universally when the community is being attacked or comes under a threat. I don't know that we are at a time and a place where we can look to external threats to be the main mode of our civic engagement and have that be sustainable. So look, I think the way to answer your question very concisely is the times where we have seen the community under threat, largely immigration-related issues, and those issues have the unique ability to bring first, second, third generation Latinos together, monolingual Spanish speakers who are recent immigrants, and third, fourth, fifth generation monolingual English-speaking folks of Latino descendancy together, right? The community is under a threat. We are seeing turnout. We did see a record number of Latinos turn out in this election cycle for a gubernatorial off term. We did see a record turnout amongst Latinos in November of 2016. So the last two election cycles, we are seeing record turnout. But barring an affirmative aspirational message, the negativity is not enough. And I don't think that's a bad thing for the Latino community. I think it's really a shameful statement on our body politic and the two parties.
And in your opinion, neither party is really focused on issues of concern to Latino voters. Well,
I agree with that.
Yeah. Okay. And
and I'm not saying that there aren't good issues that are being brought up, but you know, 20 years of looking at Latino polling data saying the number one issue is jobs, the economy, and education, those are never the front row issues. We don't call those Latino issues, while they clearly are. Our issues tend to be driver's licenses for the undocumented, building a wall, Dreamers, all very important issues. But they're not speaking to the hearts and minds and the economic everyday concerns of the average Latino voter and what they've been telling us for 20 years they want to hear about.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you. Yeah, go ahead.
And I'll just elaborate a little further. So from my perspective, there has been, as critical as it is to be countering Trump's policies and the rhetoric that's been out there for the last couple of years and the greater rhetoric that we see often from the Republican Party. Unfortunately, much of that discussion has been at the expense of talking about these other issues that are absolutely critical, not only critical to the Latino community, but can be drivers, right, to making a case for why voting is important and getting them actually to the polls. So in the 2016 election, we saw a lot of mobilization efforts in California and outside of California that used Trump as a rallying cry. And I think that was very important to many members of the Latino community. It was a factor in some folks getting out to vote, but it clearly wasn't enough. And there is not, and there has never been, enough discussion of those everyday issues that Latinos care about. But bottom line, there needs to be more investment when it comes to getting out the vote, when it comes to registration, when it comes to making the case for why it's important to, after you've worked two jobs and you're taking care of your family, why should you bother to go out to vote when nobody's asked you to vote, when it's really difficult to see why taking that step matters? And maybe you might even feel a little foolish in taking that step, right? For some people feel totally disconnected. Why do I play the game? And so in that sense, that's why, going back to the sleeping giant does suggest very strongly, right, that it's Latinos' apathy, their lack of concern, their lack of wherewithal. It's basically essentially blaming the Latino community, right, for their lack of engagement. But with all of those barriers, it's actually quite logical why we see, as frustrating, right, and as concerning as it is, it's very logical why we see these gaps, these disparities, why we see lower participation. So let's get away from the sleeping giant and start tackling, really, truly tackling some of those issues.
And then just to take it back to the crass game of politics, just very succinctly, do you think, each of you, the Latino vote, if it were to turn out at significantly higher levels than we have seen in the past, galvanized by President Trump, whatever else, could be the deciding factor in these battleground congressional races that we've looked at? Do you think that's going to happen?
Mike's thinking. I see it on
No, I mean, look, the question is, could it? Absolutely it could. It could be determinative in every one of those. Will it? I mean, history doesn't suggest that it will happen. I mean, what we're seeing is incremental growth. If Latinos were voting as a proportionate share or commensurate with the white electorate, no question you would see a dramatic political change in the country. But the demographic that is really causing Republicans a problem is not the Latino vote, although that's been a problem for 20 years. It's not becoming a problem. It's been a problem. The real big demographic that will determine control of the House is going to be college-educated Republicans, generally college-educated Republican women specifically. And that's where you're seeing the hemorrhaging in northern San Diego and Orange County.
Yeah, we've been looking over the course of this podcast at these seven districts where Hillary Clinton won, where we're seeing all this money coming in, and you're essentially creating a distinction between the Jeff Denham race, which we looked at last time, the Valadao race, and then some of these other ones that are more coastal. They have wealthier, more suburban.
Yeah. These people are having a really, really difficult time with Donald Trump and what the Republican Party has become.
You know, the one thing we didn't get into with Valadao and to some extent Denham, you know, the down ballot kind of reality, you know, that lack of mobilization, lack of outreach, lack of information, you know, people heard a lot about the presidential race, they don't know a lot about their local congressman, right? They're going off of very, very little information. So he's an incumbent. He's of the community. I heard a few things. I don't know anything else about the other person, right? Or if I did hear something, maybe I heard that they're not of the community and so forth. So as surprising as it is when you look at the numbers, kind of the reality of down ballot and lack of information and the heuristics that people go by, the shortcuts that they take when they're trying to make sense of it all, it's not that surprising then in that sense.
Mindy Romero, director of the California Civic Engagement Project at USC, and political strategist Mike Madrid of Grassroots Lab. Thank you both for coming in and joining.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
This year, Valadao is facing Democratic businessman TJ Cox. So far, different candidate, same result. Valadao trounced Cox in the primary, gathering almost two-thirds of the vote. The Cook Political Report, which handicaps elections, re-rated the race from lean Republican to likely Republican. It's one of the few places in the country that analysts think have actually gotten safer for the GOP. Coming up next time on Keys to the House, we'll look at the 30-year-old political unknown who came out of nowhere to raise millions and advance through the primaries to what's expected to be one of the state's most competitive races. Hers has also been dubbed the most millennial campaign ever. Our podcast is produced by Sally Schilling and edited by Nick Miller. Chris Hagan is our digital editor, and the executive producer is Linnea Edmeyer. My brother Matt Bradford did our music. You can get more election news at Capital Public Radio. Visit us online at capradio.org or just switch on your radio. And if you're looking to take a break from politics, we also have a new podcast for you. Check out Yosemite Land. Environment reporter Ezra David Romero explores the future of the park. New episodes of Yosemite Land come out every Monday. This is Keys to the House. I'm your host, Ben Bradford. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.